Here he is with 9 stone 12, 136 pounds as a four-year-old in the Melbourne Cup of 1930. 10,000 pounds sterling that race was worth, and the best stayers in Australia were engaged, but Firelap simply played with them. Aye, it's like he's taking candy from a baby. Firelap wins.
He's a phenomenal galloper. I think the best horse I've ever seen and ever rode.
The Red Terror, the greatest horse in the world.
In 1930, Firelap won 11 races in 11 weeks. Nothing compares with that.
We're going to lose you, and we're going to miss you. Good luck, Firelap. Australia's with you.
Going to America, Firelap was sent into the most treacherous racing environment that has ever existed.
But Firelap's got it. Come on, Firelap. Firelap, you beauty.
And then, at the height of his racing career, Firelap suddenly dies.
The Yanks killed him.
I rang Dad and said, oh, I'm going to Canberra. I said, I'll have a look at Firelap's heart while I'm there. And that's when he said, well, that'll be clever because it's not Firelap's heart, it's draft horses. Well, I just said to him, are you joking?
All the evidence is right there in front of us, in plain sight. I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Firelap, a forensic investigation. Episode 7, Winter of 2005. A seed is planted for the invisible to become visible. In the winter of 2005, Dr. Ivan Kempson's local and international peers are in Melbourne at a conference for a few days. As a well-regarded research scientist at the Future Industries Institute at the University of South Australia, Ivan is interested in pushing the boundaries of scientific examination and experimentation. He's particularly interested in the advances his peers in Chicago are making in radical microscopy using intense light beams.
Yeah, it's quite serendipitous. There's actually a researcher from the synchrotron in Canada that was visiting Australia at that time as part of our development of the synchrotron in Australia. And so there was a meeting in Melbourne around that, and at that same time he happened to visit Museum Victoria and see Firelap, and jokingly at dinner one night mentions, you know, about analysing Firelap's hair for arsenic and using the synchrotron to do that. And so that was, I guess, where the idea spawned, and someone at that dinner was also very familiar with the work that I was doing, and so then proposed that we actually do that analysis.
A perfect confluence of scientists, academics and Melbourne Museum staff come together for a conference dinner. In years to come, this dinner will prove to be a momentous turning point in the search for the truth behind Firelap's agonising death. In the genial environment, encouraged by a few glasses of wine, the Australians and the Americans jibed each other on the subject of, did the Yanks kill Firelap? The scientists know that the synchrotron in Chicago now has the ability to analyse the makeup of just about anything, and that hair in particular holds toxic compounds. Dermot Henry, head of sciences at Museum Victoria, took a pivotal role in connecting these colleagues.
I went to the Australian Microbeam Analytical Society conference, I think was the name of it. I gave a talk there, and a guy from the Australian Synchrotron, whose name now escapes me, came up to me and said, oh, you need to meet this guy, Ivan Kempson. And I think it may well have been at the conference dinner that he introduced me to Ivan, and we had a few beers and a few laughs about the possibilities of getting a sample of Firelap's hair. And I did say to him that won't be a trivial thing to do. Just getting into Firelap's case in itself is not a trivial thing to do. But we talked about the idea, and I suggested that we pull together a proposal and we would put it to the museum hierarchy around getting access to some of Firelap's hair and go from there. So yeah, it was an exciting idea. We had a chat about, you know, a few other projects that had gone on, like people had tested Napoleon's hair, I think, and also Beethoven's hair. So we thought, why not Firelap, great Australian icon? We did have a few laughs around who who nobbled Farlap, was he fed poison? There was always, you know, the stories around him either deliberately being whacked or also, I think, eating in an orchard that had been sprayed by lead arsenate. So it was another theory as well. I think I was introduced to Ivan at the conference after I gave my talk. A person from the Australian Synchrotron said, oh, you need to have a chat to Ivan. And we caught up. And then I think at the dinner or one of the evenings of the conference, we had a bit of a chat and started to flesh it out. And, you know, of course, in my role, I explained to him around some of the logistics and that you know, just sampling Farlap and doing taking some hairs away would be controversial in itself. So it wasn't it was a great idea, but it wasn't necessarily going to be easy to get the project up.
What started as a light-hearted, fanciful discussion became a serious investigation. The Melbourne Museum gave permission for a small square of hide to be taken from Farlap's taxidermied effigy.
We had three trips to the Argonne facility in Chicago, and I was there for all three trips, helped out on the beam line. And so on the very first trip, early on, we started to do some chemical mapping of the hair, the cross sections of the hair, and started to see arsenic there. So that was exciting. We felt we were onto something. Although we also, the analytical side of it is quite complex and it's not straightforward. So we, you know, just finding arsenic in Farlap was one aspect of it, but then showing that it wasn't related to the taxidermy process, for example, was another. So there was a lot of work to be done, but it would have been disappointing on day one if we'd actually found no arsenic. So it was quite exciting. It kept us going. At the synchrotron, you have time on the equipment for 24 hours a day, so we try and maximise that. So by the end of 6 days, you're fairly well knackered, actually. So, you know, getting some hints of arsenic in the first day or so was very exciting.
What they find is jaw-dropping. Each hair shows a massive spike in arsenic near the hair root, indicating Farlap has ingested an enormous amount of lead arsenic in the hours before his death.
But again, we're also mindful, you know, it's a scientific process. So, yeah, of course, we were excited. We thought, oh, well, this is really great. But there's a lot of work in determining what that spike actually means and how big it is as well. But no, absolutely, you know, when you're sitting there in the middle of the night and you're starting to look at some of the results and seeing arsenic and what look like big spikes of arsenic, then, yes, you think, well maybe we will get an answer out of this process.
The hair that was below the skin level and close to where the hair was actually growing when he died, we saw this big spike of arsenic. And so that really perked our interest, thinking that, you know, maybe this is actually indicative of consumption of arsenic. And so we really studied that a lot further.
2 years later, in 2008, the Australian Synchrotron is up and running in Melbourne, with facilities superior to that of Chicago. In the scientists' minds, there remains a grey area in their analysis of Farlap's poisoning. They want to clearly identify arsenic that is used in Farlap's taxidermy process against the arsenic that is ingested right before his death. Dr. Ivan Kempson again puts Farlap's hairs under the intense fluorescent light beam analysis. All the hairs show low-level lead arsenic bands in a flat line, indicating the arsenic used in the taxidermy process on the hide. Chemical analysis shows that the large spike in arsenic at the root of the hairs contains blood products, whereas the layer of arsenic along the outside of the hair does not. This clearly separates the taxidermy-applied arsenic from the ingested arsenic. When I spoke with Dr. Kempson, he confirmed that the time frame for the ingestion of the arsenic could be anywhere from 9 to 30 hours before Farlap's death, depending on the rate at which Farlap's hair grew. Farlap died 9 to 10 hours after Bill Nielsen administered the capsule to Farlap. If only Tommy Woodcock was alive to see these wonderful scientific results that proved him correct that Farlap had indeed been poisoned. Finally, we had the hard evidence of one massive dose of arsenic, not a gradual build-up from tonics or poisonous oats or pastures. A little later, I was glad he wasn't alive to hear the stories that went around in newspapers, radio, and the internet, once again surreptitiously pointing the finger at Tommy Woodcock. My own synchrotron tests. My father, Cliff, is the executor of Tommy Woodcock's will, and amongst the many treasures Tommy left to my mother and father are three strands of Farlap's hair that Emma pulled from Farlap's tail when the newlyweds were spelling Farlap on Sol Green's property Underbank at Bacchus Marsh, Victoria. Farlap spelled here for 5 months between March and August 1931. The Woodcocks have a wonderful holiday away from the hustle and pressure of Farlap's harsh racing regime. It is a rare opportunity to be left to themselves to enjoy peace and tranquility in the lush Underbank property environment. I was very keen to have these hares put under the same tests as Farlap's poisoned hares that had been taken from his taxidermied hide. It would be interesting to see if there was any arsenic from tonic present in the hares while Farlap was totally under the care of Tommy Woodcock. Dr. Ivan Kempson was also very keen to look at the chemical makeup of these hares taken when Farlap was alive. Professor Andrew Peel, director of the Australian Synchrotron in Melbourne, and his team gave me access to 3 days of tests at the synchrotron. Assisted by scientist Dr. David Patterson, Ivan tests 18 centimetres of two strands of the tail hair measured from the root bulb. This represents approximately 7 months of growth. The monitors display colours that represent various chemicals. We find no arsenic traces at all in these hares. What does this mean? Farlap wasn't racing during his time at Underbank, so performance was not an issue. If back at the stables Harry Telford gave Farlap tonics as a general routine, then certainly we can say that when totally under Tommy Woodcock's care at Underbank, Tommy did not give Farlap an arsenic-based tonic at all. Tommy was not a fan of tonics and firmly believed that a champion racehorse like Farlap did not need any stimulants. So it does not surprise me that these hares are free of arsenic. Harry Telford, on the other hand, was a great believer in horse tonics and had a recipe book full of various tonic stimulants and cures with ingredients that, while freely available back then, are on banned lists today. Harry's tonic book is on display at the Melbourne Museum and features his handwriting expressing his general tonic containing arsenicalis and nucus vom, strychnine, as a great tonic for all horses. The wood for the trees. It is fair to say there are several vested interests in the story of how Farlap died, including the proponents of a bacteria poisoning theory, Bacteria Clostridium difficile, known as anterior enteritis, which makes the stomach explode. The problem is that these professional diagnoses were certainly made with best intentions, but at the time of forming the diagnosis, these practitioners simply did not have all the evidence at hand, particularly from the indisputable synchrotron tests showing the alarming spike in arsenic uptake in the hours before Farlap's death. Perhaps the saying, "can't see the wood for the trees," is most apt to the many commentators who speculate on how Farlap died. As celebrated Australian detective Ron Iddles would say, "the answer is always in the file." The file in this case being the two post-mortem reports from the vets at the scene, stating poisoning by substance unknown. Racing in the 1930s was a bad game and still is today to a shocking extent. Only recently in Australia, a chief steward's house was shot at in gangster style from a moving car while he and his family were inside. Racing officials investigated and charged some of racing's elite for injecting their racehorses with illegal substances. Others were prosecuted for using electric shocks and manipulating race outcomes. In the 1930s, Farlap's owners knowingly bring their outstanding horse into a criminal atmosphere where 24-hour armed guard is necessary. In this anything-goes atmosphere of high rollers and huge stakes, the malevolent are at play beneath the surface of the dazzling Art Deco casinos. Draped with beautiful women and the see-and-be-seen Hollywood types, they are all on the make, just as they are today at the Spring Racing Carnival in Melbourne. The champagne flows amidst the fun and hoopla of celebrities and fashionistas, all plugging their particular brand for themselves and powerful affiliated interests. Racing is not called the sport of kings for nothing. Owning a racehorse is an expensive business. Add to that the business of bookmakers and gamblers who play each other at rorts and fixing, we find there is a hellish amount of money to be won and lost. When Farlap's owners successfully stage a betting scam manipulating the running of the Caulfield and Melbourne Cups, they are assured of winning an unlikely doubles bet by scratching Farlap at the last minute. The result is that Farlap is shot at by the callous, hired thugs of irate bookmakers. When Farlap's owners, particularly Dave Davis, win massive amounts on bets placed all over the United States on Farlap to win in Mexico, Farlap is again a target for the bookmakers and their thugs. The scenario in Australia basically repeats itself in America. Arsenia Carlos. Arsenic is a strange poison. Let's take a closer look at arsenic. Like many herbs in small doses, it has therapeutic effects during short-term use, but in large doses, it is poisonous and deadly. The intriguing yet frustrating aspect of arsenic poisoning is that its symptoms, while all horrible, exhibit differently. Effects on the body and symptoms are wide-ranging. The same symptoms do not occur in every victim. This is why it is difficult to decipher arsenic poisoning. So in autopsy, when poisoning is found to be the cause of death, often only minuscule traces of arsenic can be found. Dr. Ivan Kempson says the fact that any traces at all of arsenic were found at Farlap's autopsy suggests that a large amount would have had to have been present shortly before his death. Many practitioners say that diarrhea also accompanies arsenic poisoning. Dr. Kempson disputes this, saying that arsenic poisoning is difficult to determine in any animal or human, as arsenic has varied and different effects.
And similarly for arsenic poisoning, if we look at reports of poisoning in animals, the animals present differently as well between each other. So some reports different symptoms to other animals where arsenic poisoning has been confirmed.
Dermot Henry at Museum Victoria concurs.
In the 90s, there was a case where about seven or eight thoroughbred racehorses were poisoned at a stud by a disgruntled worker, I think. It was interesting because the autopsies of the horses were very similar results to what was seen in Farlap's autopsy. But also the vet that did the work, the autopsies, actually stated that if they hadn't actually recovered the oats and discovered they were laced with arsenic, he wouldn't have been able to say that's what the poison was, because the arsenic isn't encapsulated in the organs of the body. It gets excreted out. And so by looking at the organs, they had, you know, small amounts of arsenic in it, but as probably do yours. He stated that if they hadn't found the oats, then he would not have been able to say arsenic was the toxin that had killed the horses. And so it was quite interesting that the autopsies were very similar. The results of the autopsies were very similar to Farlap's.
As with most iconic legends, there is no end to the stories created around Farlap's life and death. In the public arena, there are many accounts of how Farlap died, and there are a gamut of Tommy told me stories. These stories are usually incorrect and always have flawed information. I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Farlap, a forensic investigation. Technical producer is Richard Di Gregorio.
Hi, Richard here. We'll be putting up two episodes every week of Kerry's amazing investigation, Killing Farlap. There are 9 episodes in all, so make sure you subscribe and the episodes will automatically come into your podcast library. We welcome any feedback and comments, and hope if you enjoy the podcast, you will give us a star rating and review. Thanks for listening.